Hey, y'all, Scott here. First of all, thanks to the show's sponsors and donors who make it possible for me to do this. Secondly, I need more sponsors and more donors if the show is to continue. ScottHorton.org/donate has all the links to use PayPal, Give.org, Google Wallet, WePay.com, and even Bitcoins to make a donation in any amount. You can also sign up for monthly donations of small and medium-sized amounts through PayPal and Give.org. Again, that's ScottHorton.org/donate for all the links. To advertise on the site or the show, email me, scott@scotthorton.org. And thanks.
On to our next guest. It's the great Adam Morrow. He's a reporter, like Gareth, for Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net. But he's living in Cairo. Welcome back to the show, Adam. How are you doing?
Good. I'm good, Scott. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I really appreciate you joining us. And anyway, all right, so hey, today's Friday, so today's a big day. Are people chilling out? Are the battle lines getting harder? People are getting madder? Or I saw the coalition splitting, so maybe more factions have the fact that they have no power in common now and they can start being friends again? I have no idea. Tell me what the hell's going on in Egypt.
Sure. Well, what you have now is in the wake of President Morsi's oust a week ago, or I think it was on the 3rd of June, you now have an interesting dynamic where you're seeing the Islamist ranks, or the various disparate Islamist parties and groups unifying behind calls for the reinstatement of Morsi, versus what used to be the opposition, which is now in power on the back of the military, is actually now in a state of fragmentation, where just a month ago you had the opposite. You had this very all of whom were thoroughly behind Morsi's ouster, all of whom were thoroughly behind, all lining up to take aim at Morsi and were unified in their demands for Morsi's removal. And now all of that is sort of falling into disunity and disarray now that they actually have power, while the Islamists, who had previously been in a state of disarray and sort of division over various things when they were in power, are now unified behind calls, like I said, for Morsi's reinstatement. So it's interesting. You do have a shift in dynamics. More unity on the part of Islamist ranks, who have all sort of come together and coalesced behind this, calls to reverse this military overthrow. And now you have the different opposition groups are now raising their various concerns about the seemingly unlimited powers that this new interim president has. So this is an interesting development, an interesting turn of events. I don't know if you know, also today there were massive demonstrations, pro-Morsi demonstrations in the capital and in several Egyptian provinces. But it's very difficult, unfortunately, it's very difficult to gauge how large they are, mainly because of the incredibly slanted nature of the media. If you remember from our last conversation, as soon as Morsi was ousted, the authorities immediately shut down all Islamist channels, six Islamist channels, I believe. So it's very difficult to get the Islamist side of the story right now. So it's very difficult to determine just how big these pro-Morsi demonstrations are. From what I can tell, Gezira is showing them, but Gezira's coverage is very limited. And Gezira has, for the most part, been declared persona non grata under Egypt's new military regime. So it's difficult to gauge how big they are, but certainly from the limited amount of footage we're getting, there are definitely tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of people out on the street demanding Morsi's reinstatement.
Wow. Okay, so let me oversimplify it, and it'll be oversimplified, but you tell me if I'm wrong outright, but I just want to make sure I understand
Sure.
what you're saying. You had the Muslim Brotherhood in power for about a year there, and then in the opposition, at least de facto coalition against him, you had the old regime militarist, you had whatever so-called liberal groups, which I guess just means like labor unions and university students and stuff like that, and then and then the Salafis. And then, but see, I think that's probably where I'm really oversimplifying is who all's who and the Salafis or whatever. But they were part of the opposition and even part of the opposition that was so impatient that they didn't want to wait for elections or anything. They agreed with the militarists and the liberals to go ahead and overthrow Morsi now. But now you're telling me, I think, that they've already taken that back in a way and said, no, you know what? We actually like Morsi a hell of a lot better than you guys. And mostly as a result of the form of the military power grab and how they've set things up so far and who's supposed to get what power sharing, and they're now balking and getting pissed off and switching sides back to the Brotherhood. Is that correct at all?
Well, the only oversimplification you're making here is when you refer to the Salafists. It's not all of the Salafists, which are actually a formidable force. The Salafists are actually quite a formidable force, and they got roughly 25% of the parliament in 2011-2012. The group that stuck around and endorsed the military takeover, the one Islamist party that basically broke off from the rest of all the other Islamist groups and parties, it's just one Salafist party. There are multiple Salafist parties, but this is traditionally the largest Salafist party, called the Noor Party, which itself has seen, even before this incredible showdown on June 30th, had already seen massive defections by a lot of its membership. In fact, other parties started to, there were break-off parties from it and that sort of thing, because they basically saw it as being too oppositional. It basically got into bed with the opposition to Morsi. This is a super ultra-conservative Salafist party, and it was basically getting into bed with these incredibly liberal, with the incredibly liberal opposition, at the expense of the elected president who comes from the relatively moderate Muslim Brotherhood. So that party was already sort of had a serious identity crisis that it was facing. And then what it did when it saw the size of the protests on June 30th, it basically joined opposition, it joined calls for early presidential elections, but was the only Islamist party to do so. All the other Islamist parties immediately backed Morsi, even though they might have had, you know, their own personal smaller scale differences with the Brotherhood. They've all backed Morsi. And now that we're 10 days or so into this thing, the Noor Party has definitely balked. For example, when it saw that when two big liberal figures were touted to take up the premiership, for example, it vetoed both of them. You know, it suddenly found itself in this very difficult position, very hard to justify position, where it's, you know, where it's basically in this same coalition against an elected president with a bunch of its ideological rivals, you know, with a bunch of its ideological nemeses. So, from the last thing that I heard, it had withdrawn from the government, and it's distanced itself from the, and I think the reason they're doing that is basically it's the only way to preserve their Islamic credentials. If they were to stay with this new military backed government and give it its endorsement, it would have been, I don't think it would have had much of a political future, because I mean it would have been seen as a massive sellout, to this new interim government at the expense of the Islamist parties and groups. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, I dig it. So now, the elections, the military has announced that there won't be a presidential election for 2 years, right? They'll have a parliamentary election next year. We'll include the Brotherhood. You guys can run again.
Well, this is what's so incredible, are these incredibly disingenuous calls for, you know, talk about, oh, how inclusive we are and how democratic we are and we want everybody to participate. I mean, you just backed the military overthrow of an elected president, and then you're acting like you've got the good grace to allow them to compete, and they don't want to exclude anybody from the political process and the democratic process. It's very, very Orwellian, some of the stuff we're starting to hear now, in terms of, you know, the verbal gymnastics people are playing in order to avoid calling this a military coup. You know, there's a lot of people are still in fantasy land and are still think this is just a reflection of the popular will, and haven't yet come to terms with the fact that this was a public relations coup from beginning to end. And like we said last time, I seriously don't think it could have happened without a green light from the U.S. government from the U.S. government, which has been so incredibly closely involved in the Egyptian military for the past 30 years plus. So if that goes some way towards answering your question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Eric Margolyes, the way he portrayed this situation was that the Egyptian military is nothing but part of the Pentagon. And if this happened, right, it's because the Pentagon did it, basically. And, you know, they're so closely linked together that there's just no other conclusion you could come to, basically, was his conclusion, you know, from where he
right,
his
right.
understanding right, of the yeah. relationship.
Right, right. Yet at the same time, you've got these opposition groups, you know, these groups that have just come to power on the back of the military, basically trying to make themselves out to be like the ones that are sort of, you know, bucking U.S. policy, you know, trying to make themselves, they're trying to cast this whole myth that it was like the Brotherhood was actually America's choice, and that this whole big military overthrow that just happened came despite the U.S., which just, you know, if anybody knows anything about the region or the history of the region, I mean, it's just a very, very difficult to swallow.
All right. Now,
hey, can I ask you a question? What kind of coverage is the pro Morsi demonstrations getting in the Western mainstream media?
Well, you know, I got it on CNN International today, and I'm not seeing anything. I haven't had a chance to look at Al Jazeera or anything else, but
this is sort of typical where you see like any sort of anti-Morsi activity is highlighted by the media and gets a lot of attention, and yet when you have instances of pro-Morsi activity that's happening like today in Cairo with these demonstrations, the media, both local and international, seems to just ignore it,
Disturbing. I guess really the way to judge it as far as CNN International, I guess, would be how much attention Amanpour plays to it in an hour or so when her show starts. I think that's, you know, she's pretty much got that's been delegated to her to cover or not, I think. You know what I mean? The rest of them,
they're just
talking about soccer and plane fires and stupid, you know, rainstorms and whatever, you know?
Right.
But,
right.
All right, well, so, I don't know. The U.S. role, if you go all the way back, the Brits helped create the Muslim Brotherhood in the first place. They worked very closely with the CIA to marginalize commies and socialists and nationalists, through the decades. And then, but I guess for the last 30 years, they've been very much suppressed. I don't know what the CIA role with the Muslim Brotherhood has been since, say, Reagan or whatever, or since Carter,
Mubarak. This is a big question that I've noticed comes up in our conversations a lot, and it's a important element in the equation. We know that all groups, to some extent, are going to be co-opted. We've learned that the hard way, that all groups everywhere are co-opted in one way or the other by the powers that be. Now, the question is just how badly co-opted was the Muslim Brotherhood? Was it a creation of the U.S., like you said? You know, its detractors here will accuse it of being a Freemasonic organization and things like this. I mean, that's a very, very good question, and you can't really get a bead on what's actually happening until that question is answered. I don't know. It's still sort of open to question. However, I will tell you that what just happened on June 30th, the fact that the military stepped in and pulled this thing off and on the back of this crazy public relations coup, it strongly suggests that they were perhaps more independent than we thought they were. You know, I mean, it's an indication that the powers that be wanted them out. And if the powers that be wanted them out, then that suggests that they did, you know, they did represent a level of independence.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's also difficult to determine because Morsi really didn't have that much of a chance to govern. We only saw him, in the presidency for 1 year, during which time he was putting out fires left and right, during which time he was trying to tame this Mubarak-era deep state, which still remains completely in place, undisturbed from 2.5 years ago, still remains, and I'm talking about the police, I'm talking about the military, I'm talking about large segments of the bureaucracy, Egypt's massive, sprawling, quasi-socialist bureaucracy. The Mubarak-era deep state still remains firmly in place, in those areas. And Morsi got resistance on all fronts in his 365 days when he got to govern.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to tell. It's very difficult to tell what he was going to do. I will point out, though, that people really haven't mentioned is that his entire time in power, practically, Egypt was negotiating for a big IMF loan package, if you remember, a $4.8 billion loan package, and they never sealed the agreement, which leads me to believe that Egypt under Morsi was basically pushing back and was basically saying, look, we're desperate for this money, but we're not gonna just sign all of these preconditions. We're not gonna sign on to all these preconditions that the money comes with. So they were obviously not. There was some resistance, you know. They hadn't agreed to anything yet, and they were still in the process of negotiating.
I didn't understand that aspect of it. I guess I had thought that he had gone ahead and started implementing the reduction of the subsidies, and I mean, he was damned if he did and damned if he didn't anyway, right? But
No, yeah, but they never reached final agreement. There were some points where he sort of tried to do a couple things, tried to raise taxes a little bit, but there was a big public outcry, and he had to reverse those decisions very quickly. But a final agreement on the loan and the loan conditions was never reached. So this is just something to bear in mind.
Yeah. And now, so I want to ask you about, well, hell, man. I want to ask you lots of different things at the same time. Let's focus on what you talked about, the Mubarak's deep state that refused to give an inch to the democratically elected whatever the who's. It's there was a piece in the New York Times I'm sure you must have seen. In fact, I have it here. Sudden improvements in Egypt suggest a campaign to undermine Morsi. And
Is that the New York Times?
Yeah, New York Times. And I was trying to remember, I'm pretty sure it was Eric Margolis who went ahead and stuck his neck out and said, and this is something that you obviously very well could have predicted yourself, judging from everything you've ever said on the show in the past couple of years, that you just wait. I bet you give them a few days and all of a sudden the cops are going to be out on the street providing security. All of a sudden there's going to be better
electric
service.
And by the way, many normal Egyptians, many average Egyptians have been very quick to point that out. I've had several people saying, Deb, have you noticed that the benzene crisis, you know, the gasoline crisis and the, these various shortages, there have been no electricity cuts. Mm-hmm. You know, there were chronic electricity cuts going on in Cairo and in the governorates for months.
Margulies wasn't shy at all in saying that. Look, this Mubarak's deep state, they refuse to cooperate with the Brotherhood's so-called regime for the last year whatsoever, basically, that they, the elected, would get all the blame, and then they would be able to go back to the way things were.
It's simple, but it's absolutely spot on, Scott. I mean, that's basically what's going on. I think the master plan was to basically trip him up and to destabilize the country absolutely as much as possible. And that includes, calling constant demonstrations so as to hurt tourism. You know, tourism numbers were low. To create these chronic shortages of basic necessities, including fuel, bread occasionally, massive electricity cuts. And I think basically that this was the idea, was to just sort of alienate the public and make it look like life is worse under Morsi than it was under Mubarak. I mean, Mubarak might have been a dictator, but at least he kept the electricity coming, at least he kept the fuel supply coming, at least he did this, at least he did that. And that's basically what they did. They did that for a year, got a lot of people upset with this nonstop media barrage against this anti-Morsi stuff, and basically this very, very disingenuous tendency to basically put everything on Morsi, put the responsibility for absolutely everything on Morsi. I mean, there was no empathy whatsoever. It's like you'd think, this guy's got the most difficult job in the world. This guy has just been elected to the absolute most difficult task in the world, which is basically rebuilding Egypt after 30 years of Mubarak. He was not given any leeway by his critics. I mean, his critics held him to task for absolutely everything. And in many cases, what bothered me the most about the opposition is that they would help him create the problem. You know, they would actually create the problem, like calling for constant demonstrations. And then in the very same breath, they would turn around and say, oh, look, since Morsi took over, tourism is down 20%. They would actually help create the problem and then turn around and blame Morsi for the very problem that they were promoting. And that all culminated on June 30th with this massive public relations putsch when they managed to get several million people out on the street, and they turned it into a big festival. And the army very, very quickly, before any violence had occurred, without real due cause, immediately stepped in to assume responsibility.
That's an important point. I think everybody saw it happen, but not many people noticed it or put it into words that way or what have you. But that is certainly no one could dispute if you go back and just think about it. They really did come out with their 48-hour ultimatum thing really quickly,
very
right?
Quickly.
There was no real pretense that something's got to be done, oh, my God, or else.
Right,
you know
exactly.
what I mean? Like you said, it was a festival in Tahrir Square. It was no riot.
Exactly, exactly. And the Brotherhood and Morsi were basically just hoping to ride it out. They were like, look, we're going to have all these people on the streets for a couple of days. Let's just ride it out. And they consistently reiterated the public's right to protest peacefully, you know, the right to peaceful demonstrations. Just let them do it. Let them get their anger out. Let them get their, and then maybe we can, once it's all over, we can get back to our, you know, trying to run the state here. Mm. And then were betrayed, I guess. I mean, they had assurances from the defense minister, who Morsi himself appointed. I mean, Morsi himself appointed this defense minister. And I think they were betrayed. I think the guy, I think the guy knew even before. I mean, he was actually, you can see him sitting, attending a speech. It was Morsi's last address to the nation that he delivered on the occasion of the end of his first year in office. And the defense minister sitting there in the first row with a big smile on his face. And I'm sure that he knew even then, when Morsi was speaking, he knew what was about to happen. He knew what was coming. He knew this June 30th thing was going to be held. It was going to get massive, massive international media coverage. It was going to be spun like the Egyptian people have sort of, you know, are breaking their silence and hitting the streets, and they've had enough of this, this incompetent rule and da 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 da. And they knew full well that that was going to give them the justification that they needed to basically reassume control of the country.
Yep. All right, and now, real quickly, and we're about 6 minutes here. Real quickly, how many turned out to protest for this thing?
Is that today you're talking about?
No, I'm sorry. During the 48-hour, the all-important 48 hours there. I mean, the common term, I kind of just remember you corrected me last time. I said, 30 million people, but why? Just because I heard that somewhere? Well, apparently that's what everybody heard somewhere, was that 30 million people came out. So you can't call that a putsch, man. That was the people of Egypt's will, and they just couldn't wait for an election because Morsi was so bad.
Right, right, right. I seriously dispute 30 million. Say it was 5 million, which might be closer to the mark. But which itself is an enormous. I mean, that is an incredible feat to manage to get, you know, to get 5 million people out on the streets. That is an incredible feat. However, that being said, I would suggest that the majority of those people were not hardcore, die-hard activists who were demanding his ouster. These were just normal, sort of average, everyday Egyptians. And I know a lot of them who aren't politicized. They weren't champing at the bit to see Morsi removed from office. But they went out because everybody else was going out. People made a day of it, you know, and that's where the media comes in. That's how the media did it. The media really, really mobilized these people over the last 2 or 3 months to get people to go out. Again, even like the non-politicized class, you know, and again, I don't think all of those people were, you know, maybe you could say 10% of them were hardcore activists who weren't going to leave until Morsi stepped down. This was another thing. It would have been interesting if the army had waited. It would have been interesting to see how many. That was one of the things people were asking. How long are those people going to stay in Tahrir Square? Or would they all have left after the first day? You know, would they all have sort of left after the first day? Would they really have stayed like they had in the 18 days in 2011 that got rid of Mubarak? Were they really that committed to staying there until Morsi left?
And well,
in which case it would have been a real popular uprising. We could have said this was a.
Tell me, Adam, how do these numbers from this time compare to 2011?
Oh, they were bigger. They were bigger. But remember, 2011 was, as far as I can tell, an actual sort of popular uprising. People weren't preparing for it for months. This last thing was in the works for months, like I said. I mean, people were pushing it. Everybody was saying, like, look, our appointment is on June 30th. Don't even go out before that. Save your strength. Everybody needs to go out simultaneously on June 30th. Don't do anything else. You know, it had a lot of planning. It had a lot of money behind it. Whereas the stuff in 2011 was of a much more spontaneous nature, so it wasn't as big. And also, again, if you think about it, in 2011, people had much, much more legitimate reason to hit the streets. I mean, they were basically revolting against an unelected dictator who had been in office for 30 years and who was known to rig elections, was known to be extremely corrupt, was known to have a vile foreign policy, which basically kowtowed to the United States and to Israel at the expense of its own people, as opposed to what just happened on June 30th when you had people hitting the streets to get rid of an elected president who's only been in power for 1 year,
yeah,
you know, and has had
still,
to face,
if they were
like
bigger protests, though, I mean, that's pretty significant, isn't it?
Listen, I mean, a lot of people would argue with me, but I think that is the power of the media. When the media really wants to, you know, wants something done and devotes a lot of time and energy to it, it can move mountains.
Hey, I live in the USA. You don't have to convince me of that. I know. I didn't see the Egyptian media in the lead up to this thing, but I do know the power of the TV to tell people what they think. No doubt about that.
And
now, let me ask you this real quick.
Go ahead. It's not just the TV, Scott. I just wanted to make one really quick point on a much more general level. It's not just the TV. It's also this new, the advent of new social media, which has only been with us for about 5 years.
Right, but wait, let me ask you about this. I got a comment here from your last interview. What's your opinion about Hamdin Sabahi, who came in third in the election in the first round, not too far behind Morsi?
Yeah, he's a big leftist figure who was a big activist under Mubarak. He was very, very, a vocal critic of Mubarak's during the Mubarak era, and he was the big leftist candidate who did come in third. A lot of people said if he had made it into the runoffs, he would have won. You know, because if you remember, the runoff was just Ahmed Shafiq, the Mubarak era prime minister, and Mohamed Morsi. So it sort of put people into a box. Anybody who wanted a third, you know, a sort of third way. Mm-hmm. They didn't really have the choice. So people said if Sabahi had actually made it into the runoff, he would have beaten Morsi and he would have beaten Sabahi, or he would have beaten Shafi. Now, whether or not that's difficult to say. It's hard to say because you have the leftists here, I think, all have a sort of exaggerated sense of how big they are. I think an Islamist would have won in any fair contest, just given the sort of the demographics.
Okay. And now,
in Egypt.
We're right up against the time wall, but just very quickly, does it seem like things are calming down at all, or everybody's just getting madder, and there's a danger of worse violence, you think, or which way do you think it's going?
Yeah, no, on the contrary, I think violence is pretty much inevitable. I mean, you've taken the demographic in Egypt that won 75% of parliament in a free election, and you've basically marginalized them from the political process, despite what you might say, despite what this newfound inclusivity that everybody's stressing and urging the Islamist parties to join the political process. They have no reason to join the political process anymore. They tried the political process. They won a parliament, which was canceled by the military. Dissolved by the military. They won a presidency, which was taken from them by the military. There's not going to be any. They have no reason to participate in the democratic process anymore. So I think, I think violence is inevitable.
We got to go. Thank you very much for your time. I sure appreciate it. Adam Moore, everybody. Interpress Service, IPSnews.net.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. I think you ought to consider subscribing to The Future of Freedom, the journal of the Future Freedom Foundation, in print or online. The Future of Freedom features the best writers in the libertarian movement, the fearless Jacob Hornberger, individualist anarchist Sheldon Richman, and crusading journalist Jim Bovard, along with Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Tim Kelly, Richard Ebling, and many more. And the July issue features one by your favorite radio host on America's Middle East policy, entitled Stupidity or the Plan. So head on over to fff.org/subscribe and sign up for The Future of Freedom in print or online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com.
Oh man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com.
They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Are you sick of the neocons and the Israel lobby pretending as though they've earned some kind of monopoly on foreign policy wisdom in Washington, D.C.? These peanut clowns who've never been right about anything? Well, the Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first, and telling the lobby to go take a hike. The empire's bad enough without the neocons making it all about the interests of a foreign state. Help CNI promote peace. Visit their site at councilforthenationalinterest.org and click donate under About Us at the top of the page. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.